In the fireside room this evening, we will have a forum. The title of the forum is Water Washed, Spirit Born, How Can the Arts Help Us? Let's listen in on the forum.
Water Washed and Spirit Born has really a dynamic relationship between the two, which David has just beautifully helped us to think about, as did the children's song. That in our baptism, we're claimed by God, we're given an identity, we're made new, and that's not an end, rather it's a beginning. That if it's dying, it's also rising, and that we're then born with the E on it. You maybe noticed when we sang from With One Voice that the phrase, water washed, spirit born, appears there, and you maybe were wondering, is that a typo? It doesn't have the E on the end. Holden added for the summer theme that E on the end so that we have the sense of being carried by the Spirit out into the world, out to do our work. And it's perhaps more on the second that we focus tonight. I recall, for those of you who were here on Sunday evening in the Eucharist, Martin's homily, in which he first asked us to recall our own experience of grace, our own coming into the gospel, before he then urged us, admonished us to share that, a kind of evangelism, not out of obligation, but out of gift. Well, because of some of the things that are going on in the village this week, we have Jeff Staley talking to us about autobiography, we have David Christian and Dick Evans talking to us about faith and the arts, and other things that are probably going on around you. Marion Younghans is finishing 5 weeks as artist in residence with us this summer. It seemed like an interesting question to ask: how do the arts help us bear witness? How do the arts help us to tell our story of what it means to be baptized, what it means to encounter the gospel? Now that question can go in lots of ways, and I expect these three people will give us 4 or 12, and we'll pick among them to see where we go. But that's the frame that I have imagined for tonight's conversation. I've asked each person to introduce themselves as well as speak to us for 3 or 4 minutes on these topics, and then we'll turn the conversation wider. Julie, start.
I'm G. Barnes, and I'm training to be the program director. She'll be here for a year, perhaps more. Can you hear me now? Okay. My training, and I was drawing in three-point perspective when I was 4. That's true. And those of you who know about children's art education schemas and so on know that that really doesn't, in essence, usually happen. We don't see the world that way, typically, until later. And so my visual art life, you know, started early and was encouraged early. My mother is a painter and photographer, and my father is just kind of a seer of the world. Once, when I had come back from teaching in Hong Kong, I was sitting in the little writing and painting studio I'd made in the back of their barn. He came in from a little walk around the place, which isn't very large, I think it's a little over 20 acres, and put a slip of paper on the desk, knocked on the studio door and put a slip of paper on my desk. I said, "What's this?" And he said, "It's just a little list I thought you could use maybe in your writing or something." It was a list of 14 kinds of trees and 11 kinds of vines that he'd seen on his walk, just, you know, just for what it's worth. So he's a close observer, and that, you know, that kind of brings me into maybe some of my remarking about the topic. Without thinking, what color is tree bark? Yeah, it's lots of colors. Most people say brown. And, you know, we have that, there's a drawing that's as American as American Gothic, the painting. And that is, it's on oatmeal paper, and it has a line here, and it's painted green, has a line here, and it's painted blue. It has a house in the middle with two windows, it has a ping pong paddle on either side. And the trunk of the ping pong paddle is always painted brown. But actually, most trees that are in that position, yes, there are redwoods, yes, there are aspens, but most trees, yes, there are birches, really are gray. We come into it with a preconception as youngsters when we're 5, 4, 3, that tree trunks are brown, and so we paint them brown. We come into it because we've seen those pictures that our older brothers and sisters made, and our mothers and fathers and their mothers and fathers. That tells us they're brown. And I once asked an 84-year-old woman in a hospital bed what color tree bark was. Never mind the circumstances, but we'd had, you know, several weeks to be together in conversation. And she looked at me like I just fell off Jupiter and said, brown! And in fact, it's usually gray. In the Midwest, it takes about 3 or 4 days of solid rain for it to soak up and be brown. So what is one of the functions of art for the Christian? Well, it's to have the world as it actually is. It's through training to learn that that, you know, that mountain is 780 colors of green today at 10:01:26 this morning. At 10:01:27, it's 379 colors of green with some other colors of blue, etc. So it's to have the world as it actually is. I've trained in literary arts. I'm published as a poet and other more didactic kinds of writing. I had a dual major in undergraduate school in drama, so I've directed and acted and so on. And I think it's because I probably am just sort of one brain loaded or something, but thankfully some of that stuff kind of arcs over. In other words, to train in music arcs over and helps your math, et cetera. Otherwise I wouldn't be able to, you know, exist in the world, I don't think, as a person walking around. So I've trained in and sold and observed closely many kinds of arts. But I don't claim to be any kind of mechanic. I don't claim to be any kind of plumber. I'm a very, very unbalanced person that way. It's just art for me, and it always has been. You know, the whole world as it comes to me has been art. So you know that if you start taking pictures and you take pictures, then you never see the world in quite the same way again. You know that if you take a drawing class, you never see the world in quite the same way again. You know that if you take a modern dance class, you never hear the world, its rhythms never come to you, you never see movement, kinetic art never happens for you, kinetic stuff, streetscapes don't happen to you, you don't see people getting on and off buses and sitting on buses and bouncing on buses in quite the same way ever. So to study art and to make art and so on are ways of having the richness of the creation as much as we possibly can. I want to look and make sure that there's anything on this paper worth saying, which I jotted down. Other spectacles, I'm getting that, eh? I want to say that art and faith, that art is a way of articulating. We usually use that word for verbalizing or for writing. But I want to say, I want to borrow that and use that analogously to say that the world and our faith in it and our faith in the Creator and our faith in one another, our trust of one another, our trust in relationship is articulation of image, can be articulation of movement, art writing, sound, music, lyrics, the spoken word in a play, drama, so on. And for me, that carries in it a richness that cannot happen otherwise. Now I want to borrow an analogy. Let me stop and then rewind. In my poems, I think that my main job as a poet is to discover metaphor. Now, other poets will tell you that their main job is something else, but my main job is to discover metaphor, not to invent it or to impose metaphor over a landscape that's not already there, but simply to discover what's already out there. Let me use this analogy of analogy. I think that begins to be called metaphysics, isn't that what it is? A picture of a picture is metaphysics. In other words, in design, if I were just to go over here on the board and draw a strong vertical line, that's a discovery of something. And in architecture and in the arrangement of a painting or sculpture or whatever, or the arrangement of words on a page, if they're in a tall, narrow column rather than in paragraphs, that's a discovery, and that means something, and it has always meant something in all cultures to all people everywhere. It's symbolic of growth, okay? It's symbolic of stability. If you have a strong horizontal organization, that is one of repose. That's why you often see people would have a landscape over their sofa, okay? Is one of ease and repose and comfort. A strong diagonal is one of change and or tension, okay? Something's falling down, something's being raised up, so, you know, but it's, and one of my favorites is a flight of stairs seen from the side. That's a strong diagonal made out of equal parts of repose and growth in the steps and rises of the stairs. Well, those aren't manufactured by the artist, whatever kind of artist it is, whether it's a painter or a writer or whatever. Those organizations are already out there. And for me to find metaphor, I once used in a poem the line, under caps of lumpy frozen snow, the sage along the road has become cauliflower. It just looked like that to me. And I realized in a moment that it always had looked like that to me. That heavy snow arranged on sage looks like a cauliflower head. And forever now, that's how they look. A quick notion and then I'll shut up. I want to borrow then an analogy from the kind of contemporary sports education, athletic education world, where they now talk about a lifelong sport. It used to be that we used to sit on our butts on a little thing about this big with four piano wheels on it, scoot around and play dodgeball. And that was not a lifelong sport. It was just something that you could do in the seventh grade in the gym. But now they encourage you to have a number of try-on experiences with what could serve as lifelong sports. Discover first, for example, according to your somatotype and many other things, whether or not you're a team person or an individual person, whether or not your lifelong sport would then be shooting hoops or playing golf. And what I'm suggesting is that all Christians could have, and all of everybody actually, but especially Christians who want to be attuned to the creation and be creators, as David was talking about in the session this afternoon and so on, ought to have many try-on experiences with arts so that they could discover their lifelong art or arts. Why? As modes of expression, which we are entitled to, which we require in ways of expressing to one another, in ways of interchanging with one another, interchanging with God, and interchanging it in our interior landscape. Why? Well, to reconcile our emotional, our intellectual, and our spiritual personas. And then I'll hold it at that.
Good.
Thanks, Terry.
I'm Terry Larson, and I'm from, I think, Maple Grove, Minnesota. We just moved there, so I'm not quite sure it's home yet. But it is my privilege to serve as village musician here for the next 2 weeks. Music has been my life since the day I was born, I think. My fondest memories, most memorable memories, are the ones where I was in a musical organization or had a chance to play or do things in context with worship. When we talk about music, one of the arts in worship, it is an incredibly powerful ministry, and it is also very volatile. People's emotions and so much of their being is wound up in the musical expression. It's amazing to me that some people react so violently against this or so adamantly for that, and it becomes quite a chance to bear witness in terms of being the director, and my specialty is choir. I do the volunteer choir thing. And even at the Basilica of St. Mary, it's still a volunteer choir, and we still deal with those things. But why do people come? And so much of what you said is so true in terms of music as well. It is a higher form of expression. It is something that many people feel is the only way, and in my life as well, that I've been able to express my deepest need and longing. And the times where I think of the times when I was in despair or when I was feeling such joy, the only thing I could do was sit at the piano and play or sing. It is sung prayer. It is, when I think of a choir, choirs are such wonderful things. People of diversity coming together to create a unity. It is such a powerful symbol. It is where that the community happens. And I am so amazed that people in my choir, and I'm sure in yours if you sing in a choir, I have people who are so, so busy. I mean, they're lawyers, they're doctors, they're whatever, and they're there, you know, Wednesday night and on Sunday to sing and to express the inexpressible. Because for me, so much of faith, so much of my faith finds its expression in music. Because you can say, to you, O Lord, I lift my soul. Or you can sing, to you, O Lord, I lift my soul. You know, there's something about attaching the text with melody that creates a whole different picture. And people respond, and they hear it, and it is so powerful. And I asked my husband, if you've been here while I've heard him sing or play, so why do you play? And he said, first of all, I said it was a higher form of expression, and secondly, that it was a gift to the congregation. And I know many, I feel that way. I at one point, I was a tour soloist at St. Olaf in the band, and I played the marimba, and I played this wild piece, you know, it's all over the place, and someone came up to me and they said, how do you hit the right notes? And I said, I don't know. I don't know. I just do it. It's just there. And I think anybody who plays in this, I can't fathom playing like euphonium like Don does. If I blew one note, I'd pass out. But I'm serious. I'm a percussionist to the core. I bang on things. But to connect the spirit of your body, the breath in your body, to create a sound out of this instrument, to go out there and to go upward. And I always tell my choir, it is such a miracle for vocal cords flapping to create the sound. You know, it is such a miracle, and it's such a healing thing. Otherwise, people wouldn't come. And we bear witness to our faith all the time when we open our mouths and we sing the text. We sing that hymn, and we touch people who have written it, you know, and we create this unity. And I could go on and on, but I'll stop there.
I'm Jim Frederick. The past year I've lived on Whidbey Island in Puget Sound, and before that, Los Angeles was home all my life. Again, I'm not quite sure where home is now. It's well settled. I'm an Episcopal priest. I work in various media, in film, video, slideshows, do some biblical storytelling, some music, and creative liturgy has been something that I've done since I was ordained 26 years ago. And the image of immersion into the waters is somewhat of the way I approach the use of the arts in liturgical experience, which, and I suppose everything I do, I try to immerse people in some kind of experience. But in liturgy, you can use all the senses, and senses are so rarely, they're usually so underutilized in liturgy, in most of them, and. Often we just sit there and take it in a very interior mental way. And Now, Lutherans are better than Episcopalians, I know, singing at least. I worked a lot with that, trying to immerse people in all the senses so that they can experience things in a somewhat intense way. And hopefully that will both create vehicles of expression, as you say, higher forms of expression, but also sometimes break through some of the boundaries. And that, of course, requires congregations that are accept some risk-taking, and that sometimes it's okay to fail in a liturgy in terms of, well, that didn't work, or we didn't really like that, or that I think you went the wrong way with that, but that's okay, because we trust what we're about here as a community exploring. Because arts can be dangerous, in a sense. You never know where they're going to go. Kind of like, the Aslan, the lion in C.S. Lewis in the Narnia Chronicles. The lions are dangerous. I mean, they may bring salvation, but they're dangerous. You never know when they're going to bite you back. And so much of what Christians do is domesticated. I mean, we try to be nice all the time or safe all the time or everything's fine. And we underutilize the dark side of Scripture, for instance, and name that, and just let it be, and live with it. So we can talk about more about that aspect. I just thought of a couple of things that people said that have influenced me. One is Robert Bresson, who's one of the great filmmakers, French filmmaker, rarely seen because his work is so good. it's a little. No, he makes films where he doesn't believe in satisfying the conventions of the audience. That I'm not here to show people what they expect to see. I'm going to show them what I want them to see, something that they maybe wouldn't see otherwise. And so that's bored a lot of people. So not many people see his movies. But his critics say call him one of the best filmmakers. Anyway, he said, "Make visible what without you might never be seen." And I think that's the artist's job, and it's also, the job of people of faith too. What can we show, and make visible, that without us wouldn't be seen, or wouldn't be shown, or heard, or felt, or touched. But then I also think of what Donald Davis, who's a wonderful storyteller and also a Methodist minister. Lives on Ocracoke Island, North Carolina. I love that name. But he said, when you tell a story, tell them and tell the people enough so that they can see the story. Give them things so they can start to see it. But don't tell them so much that they see it exactly the way that you see it. And so how do we make art participatory? A work of art is never finished in that sense. As you say, we receive it from somewhere, and we shape it with whatever gifts we have, and then we hand it to you, and then it's yours to turn into whatever, and you can say, oh man, I see in that story or that image or whatever all kinds of wonderful stuff. We say, well, I never saw that. That's great. And so you start giving the art back to us, and so on and so forth. And that's just the way it works. And it goes on and on and on and on if it has authentic life. Some art deservedly has a short life. But one other thought, and then let's just open it up. What is Christian art? And I can't remember who said it. It might have been Gerardus Vanderloo in that wonderful Sacred and Profane Art. Sacred and Profane Beauty, the Holy in Art. A classic study of all the arts in terms of Christian history. And if he or somebody said this, that there is no such thing as Christian art. There are just Christians who do art. And when we try to contain art and make it useful, in a sense, I'm going to be didactic and narrow what it does and then tame it, cage it, you know, then we kill it. So let it out there and trust that, you know, God is in every story, in every image in some sense, waiting to be found in a new form that surprises us, and we're surprised all over again. So.
Well, you speak of giving it over. That's the transition point to that. Several themes that we could follow, and interesting conversations already between you about art is to have the world as it actually is, not to domesticate, not to make it what it isn't. There's a sort of prophetic element to that, to say this is what there is, not that it's necessary. Sometimes it's beautiful, sometimes it's not beautiful. Art is a way for us to experience something of God's grace, but also a way to express or to articulate what we experience, both the need, the longing, the desire, and the faith or the gift. Art is a way of both experiencing and expressing healing. And then we come to this notion of the integration of all our senses, all of our things that make us a person. A lot of different ways that could go. I know there are many people in here who've thought a lot about art, so I just want to hear from you. Or material culture.
I have an observation, but I'd like to ask a question first. And that's, as someone who doesn't do art, or in any conventional sense, what do you think that you give to me when I observe you doing the arts that you do? And I'm very struck by Terry's use of the word gift. And I think that all of you have gifts. You are giving in the process of what you do. What do you think that you give to somebody who doesn't do it?
I would have no idea. You would have to respond to that. What do you think of when somebody offers the gift? Is it meaningful to you at all, or is it something that you just kind of let wash over you? I honestly don't know. I perceive it in myself and in my husband as a gift, because I don't know. I don't know how. Of course it comes with training. I mean, I took piano lessons since I was in the third grade, but there's something about what you do and what flows through you that is certainly a gift.
There's a giving. I mean, then there's a, from the gift, there's a giving.
Yeah,
but the music. When you give a Christmas present, you have some idea of what the audience will do with it.
There's some intentionality involved, obviously. I mean, we can say, we hope this is going to make you laugh, or we hope this will permit you to cry or grieve, or that we're really hoping you're going to be surprised by this and go, oh, wow, you know. And so there's some, you know, design, you work at some of those aspects. And there's nothing like, you know, worse than, it's one thing to make a film and then you put it in a can and you send it out and you may hear back about it. You look at the sales charts or something, you know, but it's another thing to do biblical storytelling and you get out there. I remember the first time I did it and I got it there. And when I got my first laugh, you know, okay, this is great. They gave energy back. But then I've also done it where times where people sat there dead. And I thought, oh man, you know, this is awful. And they're not giving, nothing's happening. But then afterwards, you know, sometimes those people surprise you and say, oh,
that's when you just change the story to Ezekiel.
Yeah.
Where you started.
Right, right. But then we don't know. I mean, we do the best we can to prepare and try to give you as best experience, but kind of know whether it's going to be more laughter or tears, at least what we're intending. But then you may take it a totally different way, and that's fine.
Jim is pushing on something I think that is difficult in the Christian community about art as artists, performers, and audience. And does art function differently for artists and audience?
Well, let me make my observation, which is that art does very, very weird things for me, because we have a really wonderful liturgy at the church that I go to, and really wonderful choirs at St. Olaf. And often when I'm hearing those things, what happens to me is that I start thinking about teaching.
Which is your gift.
Which is what I do. And it seems to me that in some way what happens is, you know, when your vocation speaks to my vocation through I don't know how that happens, but seeing how good you are at what you do makes me want to be better at what I do.
I think there's two different aspects of the giving. I know that if my husband were here, he'd say, I give it to God, regardless of what it does for the people out there. And he knows that that is the gift that... Because when I'm... When you're saying you hope it did, all I do when I'm playing piano, like for a hymn, I just want it to have meaning. You know, I don't want to plunk, plunk, plunk. I want it to have meaning for myself and to God, and if the people respond, well, that's great. And then it has even more meaning, you know. But I know that he would say, boy, offer it as a gift to the one who gave me this ability. Because I don't know how I do it. I don't know. I don't know what it carried for her.
Yeah, I was just going to, as one answer to your question, I've heard it said that one of the purposes of art is simply to elevate the moments as they pass by, and to elevate, I guess I would add depth too. I mean, it isn't always a raising. Sometimes it's a plunging too into a deeper kind of consciousness or something like that. I don't know.
But at the very least, you're dissatisfied with perceiving the world the way you perceived it before you were touched by the art.
Mm-hmm. I hope you all noticed the way Terry elevated the last hymn. You think of gift tonight. She recast the introduction. She decorated it. She probably did some improvisation. She presented us a way in which to pay attention to a common hymn tune. We sang it, and then she nicely rounded it off so we could remember. Mm-hmm. You talk about a gift, taking something that some of us have probably sung a lot and caused us to pay more attention. So that was a special moment, a way in which she elevated the tune to get our attention. It was wonderful. And the arts do give us a degree of delight and pleasure, or we wouldn't pursue them. But, you know, that was a gift to us by her doing that, and that is what's so glorious about it.
Dan?
She said something, too, the other night that was, you said that you like loud mistakes.
See, I have a saying that I always give to my choir. Choirs who come in, we are all children. We are all afraid, and we come from the business that we do, and we lead with an iron fist or however we do it. We have all this responsibility, and we come. And who wants to come to choir? Oh, I'm getting on a soapbox, aren't I? Who wants to come to choir and be afraid? And people won't sing because, you know, the choir mentality is a whole different thing. But they won't sing because they're afraid, and I'm constantly saying, this is a place that needs to be safe. You know, because I'm a drummer. I've played drums all my life. First time I played in the St. Olaf band, okay? I was called in to do, it's a long story, but I took the second ending when I was supposed to take the first and put a stinger on the end of us, of some march. I mean, the entire band, you can't hide, you have cymbals in your hand, you know? It's not like you can look at your neighbor and say, it was your fault, you know? Like a singer. You know, and everyone looked at me. I was a freshman, you know. I was just a 5'2" little thing, and oh, that was just awful. But you know, when you're a percussionist, you got to be bold and you got to make a mistake, because if you and take that risk, and when people know that it's a safe environment, then they'll sing out. And by golly, 90% of the time they're right. They're just afraid that someone will hear them make a mistake. You know, and that's not no way to be. The arts need to be freeing, not constricting. And especially singing. That's what I believe. I'm going to write a book about this someday.
Before the art, I think there's a really common misnomer in a lot of stuff, and that is that the first function of art is to communicate, and I don't think that's true. that's certainly not, you know, the first function of art for me as a creator of art. I'm not trying to communicate something to you. So before a gift, it really is, to use an analogy or metaphor again, much more like a scientist. You know, and in pure science, pure research, there aren't failed experiments. I know they have that in the Mad Scientist movies. So it failed. Experiment failed. You know, oh, experiments cannot fail. And in when you're doing art, you cannot fail, because you, and that's why it seems risky or seems dangerous or seems, you know, because you don't know what's going to happen. You know, you start a poem or you start a painting, you start a piece of music or you start a story. You don't know where it's going to go. You know. It's a legitimate question being asked in the questioner, you know. And will the next thing be brown? And will the brown be shaped like this? Or will the brown be shaped like that? Or will it be rust, you know? And then after some, I don't know what, shelf life or something, you know, drawer life for the poem or, you know, hanging in the studio life for the painting or whatever, it comes out and can be, you know, something that can be an interchange, you know, with the viewer. So I'm kind of getting back to your question of what do I think I'm giving you? Well, at first I don't even think about you at all. Okay, and for a long time I don't. But eventually I shyly drag this thing out and say, see anything there? You know, and if you do, well, that's, you know, that's an interchange. And so that's a point at which I'm very interested, you know, in not my responsibility to communicate as the thing that drives me to even start, you know, or to pursue the discipline that it takes to see the ducky in that way, you know.
Would it be fair to say that what you think your responsibility is to be faithful to your vision and then to let me see whether or not...
Yeah, see whether or not it does anything for you. Does it ring your bells or not, you know? And I'm not disappointed. And if it rings different bells than I thought it was going to ring, that's okay too. You know, people come to me and say, oh, I see this and this and this in whatever the object is, in the poem or the painting. And maybe I put them there and maybe I didn't. You know, but I have to have put something legitimate there for it to mean anything to me. Otherwise, it's going to stay in the studio or the drawer.
Dan, you long ago had your hand up and we maybe have passed by that point to another one that you'd like to...
Well, actually, I think we've come around full circle. It was just after David's comment. And I think we've kind of come back to G's, but I was just thinking about this idea again of what the artist offers as a gift. And I think one of the primary gifts the artist offers is perception of the world. His or her particular perception of the world is a gift to people who experience that art. Monet's experience of the world is very much different from Rembrandt's. Bach's is very much different from Tchaikovsky's. Balanchine, some of his contemporary ballet, is very different from, let's say, a classical rendition in Swan Lake. And all of those are very different perceptions of the world. And I think sometimes we need to study the art to learn what that perception is about. We have to study it a lot. Sometimes it's a little bit more obvious. But I think for all great art, you've got to study it to really understand the perception and the viewpoint of the artist. And I think that's one of the greatest gifts the artist offers to people, is that different perception of the world.
It also counters our reductionist tendency to say, this is what this means, or this is what this looks like, or this is the way the world should be, or the people should be. I mean, you know, the novels can surprise us. And that it's all endlessly complex and generating new meanings. And is that not, you know, the rejoicing of the creator? Let's try this and look at it this way.
I was a little confused. Maybe I just wasn't hearing correctly, G, when you were talking about at a certain point of the process, you don't care what, you don't care about the viewer, or you're not
how it's received.
But you wouldn't embark on the whole process if you didn't know that at some point there would be a viewer or a listener, or not that you're trying to please them, but to me that's part of this whole conversation about gift and part of the whole process is I think artists need there to be an audience.
Oh yeah, I believe that. But I'm sorry.
There's a marvelous scene. There's a Tom Stoppard play, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead.
Oh yeah.
And they, the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern run into some players out in the woods and ask them to put on a play for them, and they sit down and the players start the play, and Rosencrantz and Guildenstern up and leave, and the players continue to do their theater and come across them later on. And I wish I had better memory and could remember the plaintive, forlorn speech when they come across Rosencrantz and Guildenstern at the end and say, our very being depends on there being an audience out there. We looked around and we thought maybe you'd moved, but you still weren't there, and we were crushed. And so while I think you're saying that there's a point in the process where you don't pay attention to or don't try and please the audience, it's assumed that there has to be one, and that things will be delivered in gift or whatever to the viewer at some point.
Yes, yeah. I think I'm saying yes to what you're saying, and okay. I want to try to cast my remarks in this way too. I don't ever want to get into the habit of being arrogant enough. I might accidentally be arrogant, but I don't want to be in the habit of being arrogant enough with my art to feel like each and every piece is going to be worthy even of an audience.
Right.
And it's my responsibility as an artist to keep churning out the paintings or churning out the poems. Believe me, I've written scores or hundreds of poems that you shall never see or hear. You know, they will never, be worthy of an audience. But it's up to me to keep doing those so that I get better at it, so that I get more articulate in my interior life, and I receive the world in that more, what I call realistic way. See the world as it is created and given to me each day. So I have to do all that stuff, but with any given work of art, if I could put it that way, I don't know.
Who is the self in you that listens to those poems to see if if you caught the note right? Doesn't that self contain all the experiences and interactions that you've had with other people? So that
the history of my interchanges with people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the audience is somewhat involved in your own discernment process.
I like that way of putting it.
Carol?
There's a big assumption here in my question, but I'd like to ask each of the artists here why they think, and I'm assuming that you do think this, why do you think there is such bad church art, so much bad church art?
I have a... Okay. Shoot.
And there are some artists who aren't sitting in the front, and I assume you're asking that of...
Well, I have a quick story that I could maybe this will give you, but I mentioned this the other day in a meeting somewhere. Albrecht Dürer was the, hotspit artist of his time.
Sure.
And he thought Martin Luther was the niftiest thing to roll down the pike. And he queried of Luther through letters. I read Albrecht Dürer's letters, and he queried of Luther, not to make any money, but offered that Albrecht Dürer would do a bust or a portrait or a copper vessel with a bas-relief, bust on it, or an etching or a drawing or anything, if Luther would, come to town or stay where he was so that Dürer could get there and so on, and sit still long enough to do it. And Luther didn't answer him. He put him off. He didn't answer him. Well, obviously Luther had sort of, he was very interested in music. The stained glass is pretty fine by him. But the visual arts have always suffered in Lutherdom, because he just plainly didn't much care about them. He couldn't take the time to be bothered, to put it plainly. Now, I'm offering that in sort of a silly way, but I do kind of mean that our very roots as a denomination, are kind of sloppy banners and, and then there are many other things that I'm sure that ought to be said besides my silliness here, but... we come from a long history of people who really don't give scrap about whether or not the art's any good or not.
I think there's a lot of looking backward in Christian art to try to, like, some kind of imagined golden age.
The Gothic age.
When the Gothic Revival is one example, but... trying to recreate a world. I think, great art has to be supported by a shared world of symbols. And We no longer live in a world where we have all these agreed upon symbols. I mean, the power of the Gothic age, or even the Baroque, the great Caravaggio, Rembrandt, all those folks. And, there was vigorous. I mean, they were the leading cutting edge of art in their time. It was also some age that still agreed on shared symbols and things like that, so they could still speak powerfully. Sometimes we're just trying to impose things that don't have the same vitality. So where are the roots now? There is some powerful art being made, and some of it's being made by Christians and some not. That I think is really powerful religious art. Maybe it's people in the churches either looking backward too much or playing it too safe, like don't want to give offense, or we just have to be nice, or they're not reaching down into that dangerous depth. I don't know.
Jim and then Dan.
I'm not an artist, but it seems to me that the art that does nothing for me in church art is art that tries to nail things down and has sort of decided that there's nothing mystical about religion at all. Mm-hmm. And it's also an art that has conformed to the conventions of the culture, which says essentially religion is a Sunday thing. And so only sort of gives very narrow slices of things and doesn't try to come out into the world as a whole. And that stuff is, for me, incredibly dull.
Does I think of... Okay, sorry.
I was going to say, I think there's a lot of bad church art, because I think a lot of it does appeal to a lowest common denominator. I think our culture is a very much anti-art culture. Very unlike, for example, some European cultures where art is so much a part of the culture. Here, art is so little appreciated, I think, in general, by the general populace for a variety of reasons, that I think the appeal in churches is often to a lowest common denominator of what's going to catch people without really engaging them and really taking them to a deeper place than they might think they're capable of. And I think that's so much bad art. And then I talk about art, but it's visual art, music, whatever.
Yeah. I wanted just to throw out a question on whether you can create an artist or whether an artist is born and just let loose these talents. There seems to be a trend, some discussion about that you had these gifts and you were just at a very young age, you were just waiting to let them come forth. Is there, what is the feel about, where does the artistic ability come from?
I think everybody is an artist. And that everybody had these things. And someone asked, often people asked William Stafford, the poet, when he began writing poetry. And he said, that's really not the question. The question is, when did everybody else stop? And I think that's, I really, want to legitimize that, for you. I'm as earnest about that as I can be. All people already are artists. And it might be that they have several lifelong arts, that are already in them. And I really feel that. And I have a very hard, the word talent sticks in my throat. If you're around me, you notice I never use it. Because I don't know what it means. It's too weird for me. And then in response to the notion about, all the bad art, I think you've hit on something very true there. If you look at People's Republic art, if you look at, USSR art, there's a conformity there. And that's why I said in my opening remarks, the artist doesn't know what's going to happen, and that's the experiment. In those sorts of art, and in a lot of, unfortunately, in a lot of church art, the style and the conformity and the shapeliness of it is already known ahead of time. And there's only so wide a little window that's going to pass through. And so the really wild stuff, and I think this other notion of Dan's is really true, that a lot of people that are in our pews really haven't had a lot of art experiences. My notion is, if I have a one-page poem, then the person reading it really ought to give it 45 minutes of their time. Okay, because it's taken me as much work, maybe 80 drafts or something, to do one-page poem as it does a short story, which takes you about 45 minutes to read if it's of any length. And I've seen people walk through galleries and they're saying, oh, my sister could paint that. Well, that costs $80,000. I can't believe that. A seven-year-old could do that. And they're just swiveling. It's a swivel approach to a walk through a gallery, you know. Well, to be a responsible receiver of art, I think, takes a lot of work, you know, and it takes going to the ballet. And it takes, I mean, in my case, you know, a big block for me is opera. And I've tried studying opera, and I've tried reading opera scores and a lot of stuff. And I don't rock opera, but I'm not quitting. I'm not going to let it go, because I need to be responsible as a person ready to receive the wildest and newest and strangest and most ethereal art that could come my way.
I also have that opera block, but I've decided to wait till my next reincarnation.
No, I need to say, if you're waiting for somebody else to make your point, they're not going to. Now is your turn.
Well, I think this is speaking not only of visual art, but of music and things. I heard one person say, and I believe it was at one of those theological conferences at St. Olaf, where there was things for the musician and things for the theologians. He said that in worship, there ought to be an element of mystery. You won't understand everything, but there ought to be that element of mystery, as well as that element where you feel comfortable and you know all about this. But I've often, that's very meaningful to me. The music, I'm not necessarily wowed by something I can just hear cranked out on Christian radio. I enjoy that for my own devotional life. But when I go to church, I want something higher, maybe a little mysterious, like don't fully understand.
What creates that mystery for you? A certain type of music?
Sometimes. Something worth working on.
Yeah. One that's not something you normally hear all the time. Something different.
There's a concept that is helpful to me, that art that's cultivated, and there's art that's of the vernacular. I'm impressed that you said the 80th draft of your poem before you let it out. And we sometimes have this romantic concept that the muse hits and that it just flows out. And I guess that was Mozart, but he still worked it over in his head before he wrote it out. I think that I've talked to musicians who they have tunes going through their head, composers, but they have to write them down and work it out and cultivate it. I think that's when we talk about higher art or art that has more integrity. It's been worked over. Of course, the next level would probably be folk music, which is of the people. And then there's just formula music, which is for making money. They know all the formula that will work.
Last words.
Last question.
Well, I don't necessarily mean for these to be last words, but just related to the question, how can the arts help us bear witness? I am mindful of all the people who choose which church they go to based on the music. That is one certain bearing witness that.
That's probably because there's variation in the music, but not a lot of variation in the sermons.
I know when Don and I go church shopping, it has to have a real, honest to goodness pipe organ, or we won't even consider membership. And I think it's just because we are so wanting to nurture the tradition that has been carried on through centuries. And I can't bet we went to a church, we're church shopping now, and we went to church. I mean, a lot of young families and stuff. I mean, this is a whole other can of worms, and I don't even know if we want to get into it. But yeah, I know, it's just a big, it's like, we go to a church that has an organ, they can have a piano, they can have drums and everything, I don't care, but it's got to have a pipe, or it's got to have an organ that breathes with wind. It's got to, it's interesting, it's very true. And so many people will go to churches that do not have an organ. I do not want anything to do with the organ. You know, and that to me is just amazing. It's just amazing. Sad.
Is it any more amazing than wanting an organ?
No, I know. I know. It's just a matter of how strongly we feel a certain way. But for me, it's sad because it's a tradition, and I hate to see that lost. Maybe because people don't understand it, or they have a... I don't know. Why do people end up hating the organ? It's beyond me. Maybe just because John Ferguson, you know, I don't know.
If we could all have John Ferguson yes. playing the organ in our churches, we'd all feel differently about going to church.
Well, it's true. We all formulate these opinions.
He's the organ teacher. So, no, Dick, you wanted...
Oh, I think Jim had his hand up, but I don't want to miss a thing that he might say. I'll defer. Okay.
Well, yearning for the American population to have, you know, more interest in the arts and so on, I do want the American Christian population to have, you know, more, I'm anxious for them, and it feels urgent to me that the American Christian population, and Christians everywhere, have art in a natural way. There are cultures that have no word for art because it's so infused in what they do that they don't need one. We make the words for the things. I mean, there are cultures that have no word for burglary because there isn't any. You know, there are cultures that have no word for war, you know, because they can't conceive of it, so they don't need that word. And as you have mentioned about European cultures, I spent some extended time in Japan, and everything is done on aesthetic there. When your food arrives, you know, it comes and it's placed, and then a gesture happens, and then it's turned, and then a gesture happens. And the food is arranged on the plate with an aesthetic consideration and an appeal to the eye, an appeal to the nose, and the texture of it. And if it had any sounds, they'd arrange those too, you know. And so I would like for Christians, you know, it's not just my like, but it's my fervent wish that Christians could have the world in that rich, rich way that would come from an interchange with art and artists and all the possibilities.
One of the things that would help that happen would be to honor the kinds of vernacular arts that people practice all the time. And one example of that I know of is my kids, at one point we needed to have somebody stay with our kids on Fridays because our normal daycare person wasn't going to work Fridays anymore. And we put out an ad and we got an artist who needed money. and she would come in on Fridays, and basically what they would do is art all day long of various sorts. They didn't know it was art, and that was part of that, because they just did it. But one of she ended up working with lots of different kids, and she had some connections at the University of Minnesota Gallery, and she would do kids' art shows. She would sort of take the stuff that normally ends up on refrigerators and put it in the art museum and frame it and title it and everything, and have an opening with milk and cookies. And the kids would do that. It was really remarkable because, that stuff could stand up in museums. Much of it could stand up in museums to the kind of art that is in museums. It was really phenomenal stuff. But we don't do that most of the time. We just stick it on the refrigerator and then we cover it over with lots of other stuff.
And I think that brings us to a really fundamental question, which I'll take the prerogative of the moderator to try and draw one thing to send us out with, which is about our anthropology and how we understand the way the gospel comes to us as people with many modes of being. The aesthetic, the sensory, the intellectual are all together who we are. And so we often talk about the arts in terms of creativeness and the creator. This is a way we get in touch with the Creator God, and yet there's also something redemptive about bringing art into our confession of faith, that we can be made whole, and all parts of us are part of our faith. I don't think this is the end of the conversation, as I repeat over and over, but it is time for us to move.
One short quote.
One short quote.
The Balinese, it's from McLuhan, but the Balinese have a saying, we have no art, we do everything as well as we can.
Yeah. There is a dancer already.